Do you have any questions on yesterday? Or again, I can try last week. But. No? OK. So let me remind you what we were doing. So we were talking about quantum error correcting codes. And towards the end of last time, I showed you the 9-qubit code, which was like this. And so you remember that this code could correct general 1-qubit error. And to do that, it was sufficient to check that it corrected x, y, and z errors and the identity. So what I would like to start out by doing this time is to kind of analyze this code in a little more detail and figure out exactly what we have to do, what we have to measure in order to do the error correction. OK, so I kind of sloughed that over a little bit last time. In particular, remember we have to say where the bit flip errors are and where the phase flip errors are. And to do that, remember for the bit flip errors, we were going to look at each set of 3 and say, is one of these 3 qubits different from the other 2 in the computational basis? So in particular, we can look within each set of 3 at the first 2 and say, are they the same or different? Right? And we had a, like with the repetition code, we had a little circuit that did that with 2 controlled knots. But I want to phrase that in a more quantum language. Saying there are these 2 qubits the same or different is turns out to be the same as saying, are they +1 or -1 eigenstates of Z tensor Z? Right? So remember, x is this, y is this, and z is this. And so if we have 2 zeros or 2 ones, we have eigenvalue +1. And if we have 1 0 and 1 1, we have eigenvalue -1. Okay? So the correct code words for the are +1 eigenstates of z tensor z for the first 2 qubits. And if there's been a bit flip on one of the first 2 qubits, the eigenvalue is -1 instead. And similarly, when we say, are the second and third qubits the same or different, we're going to look at z tensor z on the second and third qubits. Right? And then we want to do this for each set of 3. So we're looking at 6 of these z tensor z operators. You can think of each of these things that I've written down as actually a 9-qubit operator with the identities filled in here. But it's too much writing, and it also kind of distracts you from the important part, which is the z's. Okay, so this is how we measure the position of the bit flip errors. We measure the eigenvalues of these 6 operators. So for the phase flip errors, we want to do something similar, right? We want to say, are these 2 phases within the sets of, from the first set of 3 and the second set of 3, are they the same or different? Right, so how are we going to do that? Well, that's going to also be the eigenvalue, +1 or -1 eigenvalue of some operator. But it's not going to be a z operator, it's going to be an x operator. And so in particular, if you look at this set of 3, you say, well, xxx has eigenvalue +1 if it's plus, and it's eigenvalue -1 if it's minus. But that's just one set of 3. So if we take 2 sets of 3, and we look at the tensor product of 6 x's, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Then you'll see either we get, for the correct code words, if you get both pluses or both minuses, we'll get eigenvalue +1. Right? Whereas one of them is plus and one of them is minus, we'll get eigenvalue -1. So just like the eigenvalue of the z's tells us about the bit flip error, the eigenvalue of the x's here will tell us about a phase flip error. And then we have to just do one more, which is compare the last 2 phases. And so we can do that with this operator. Okay. So these eight operators, their eigenvalues tell us the error syndrome for this code, and in particular, how to identify what errors have occurred. Okay? Is that clear to everyone? Okay. So if you think about it, the list of operators that I wrote down here was not the unique set of things that we could have done, right? So I said, let's compare if the first two qubits are the same or different, and the second and third qubits are the same or different. But we could also have said, what about the first and the third qubits? Right? I mean, that's not independent information, right? If the first two are the same and the second and third are the same, then the first and third have to be the same as well. But what it is the information we could have used instead, right? So we could have used, say, the first two and then the first and the third, right? And that would have worked just as well. And so in particular, if you write down all of these tensor products of Pauli operators that have this property, well, these are kind of the minimal independent ones. But anything that's a product of these would work as well. Okay? And so what we could do is we can write down in particular, so let's call this the set S, the set of all operators, okay, all Pauli operators such that M psi is equal to psi for all psi in the code. Okay, so what's Pn? Pn is going to be the set of tensor products of Pauli operators. And I would like to define a group called the Pauli group which is composed of those things. So it's so it's an n composed of n qubit operators, so n qubit tensor products of the polys, I, X, Y, Z. And to make it a group, well, the polys anti-commute, right? So XZ is equal to minus CX. So a group is supposed to be closed under multiplication. So in order for that to be true, I need to add at least a minus sign. But then this Y, remember, is I, XZ. So actually, to get Y in there, I also need the phase I. So with overall phase plus or minus 1, plus or minus I. Okay? So there's 4 to the n of these tensor products, and then another factor of 4 for the phases. So there's 4 to the n plus 1 things in this group. Okay? One nice thing about including these phases in here is that I can kind of include the eigenvalues as well, right? So I could have decided if I wanted to make a different code. So in this code, all the eigenvalues are plus 1. And I've defined it that way here. Okay, but I could make a different code where I said, oh, actually, for the correct code words, some of the eigenvalues are going to be minus 1. But I don't have to change this definition. All I have to do is include in this set things that have, you know, instead of, you know, z tensor z, I could have minus z tensor z. Right, and so minus z tensor z has eigenvalue minus 1 when z tensor z has eigenvalue plus 1. Or vice versa, maybe is a better way of saying it. Okay, so anyway, this Pauli group is going to play an important role, right? So we've already seen that in a couple of places, right? So we've seen that in order to correct errors, it's sufficient to just focus on correcting x, y, or z errors. So that's one place where the Pauli group is important. And then we've seen it again here by saying, well, the code words are plus 1 eigenvectors of these Pauli operators, okay? And so let's think about the Pauli group a little bit more, and why is it so useful? And the reason it's useful is it has a bunch of nice properties. So in particular, so remember I said the Pauli's anti-commute. Obviously, that extends to the tensor products. Here. So if we have two operators in the Pauli group, then either they commute or they anti-commute. Okay? And that's kind of nice because it lets us move them past each other, and all we have to worry about is the sign. So notice that for the single qubit polygroup, you know, the only non-trivial things that can happen is anti-commutation. Right? X, Y, and Z, they all anti-commute with each other. Of course, they commute with themselves and they commute with I, but that's kind of trivial. But once you start to get the two-qubit polygroup or the three-qubit polygroup, you can have more interesting commutation, right? Like, so X tensor X commutes with Z tensor Z. Right? Because you move, you know, each X past each Z, you get a factor of minus one, but minus one squared is plus one. Okay? So you have to look at all the qubits to determine that. So let's see, what else? So another useful property is for every element of the polygroup, then either p squared is equal to plus 1 or p squared is equal to minus 1, plus or minus the identity. Okay? And if it squares to plus the identity, then it has one of these eigenvalues, plus 1, minus 1. One of these phases, plus or minus 1. If it squares to minus the identity, has one of these phases, plus or minus I. Okay? Now, this is not in any sense an exhaustive list of properties of polygroup, but these are some of the kind of the most useful basic properties. It has many more properties that turn out to be very useful when studying quantum error correcting codes. Okay? So anyway, so getting back to the codes themselves, so this set S is called the stabilizer of the code. And I mean, it's called that because obviously it's consisting of poly operators that will leave the code stable, fixed, right? And it turns out to be a very useful thing to look at when talking about quantum error correcting codes. So let's understand the properties of the stabilizer a bit better. And so, I mean, you can still think of the 9-qubit code as an example, but now we're going to try to generalize to more codes. Okay? So you come up with some kind of general quantum error correcting code, which remember is some arbitrary subspace of the Hilbert space, but arbitrary but special, right? Because you've chosen it to be a good quantum error correcting code, hopefully. And then you can define stabilizer according to this definition. Okay, let's move this up. Okay, so right, so what are the properties of the stabilizer? Well, so for one thing, I already mentioned that, you know, the ones that I wrote down for the 9-qubit code were not unique, right? We could have taken products, right? And that's obviously a general property. So if you have two operators M and N in the stabilizer, then it follows that MN size in the stabilizer as well. Why? Because MN applied to psi is equal to M, and then N applied to psi is equal to psi. Right, so this is equal to m psi, which is again equal to psi. Right, so this implies that mn is in the stabilizer as well. Okay, so that means that the stabilizer is closed under multiplication. It's also closed under inverses because, you know, remember the Pauli is square to plus or minus identity, so either they're their own inverse or if you cube them, they're the inverse. Turns out, well, okay. So that means that S is a group. Okay? So I was going to say, it turns out that that you never have to worry about the case where it's squared to minus 1 because minus 1 can never be an S. Why is that? Well, Remember, S is defined as a set of things that have eigenvalue, set of polys that have eigenvalue plus one for the code words. And minus the identity doesn't have any plus one eigenvalues. Okay. So actually that means that everything in the stabilizer squares to plus one, right? Because it has to be closed on the multiplication. And so actually they're all their own inverses. Okay. And then there's one more property, which is that S is abelian. It's commuting, right? So why is that? So remember that polys are either commute or anti-commute. But specifically in this case, they always commute. So let's prove that. So again, we have Mn in a stabilizer. And we know from here that Mn psi is equal to psi. We also know from the same argument that Nm psi is equal to psi. Right, so if we subtract this from this, we get the commutator Mn applied to psi, and that's equal to 0. Now, for general operators, this doesn't completely tell you that M and N commute, because it's possible that the commutator has some 0 eigenvalues and some non-zero eigenvalues, and psi just happens to live in the non-zero in the 0 eigenspace. But for polys, the only choices are commuting and anti-commuting. And if they anti-commute, then the product is going to be 2 times some other poly. The commutator will be 2 times some other poly. So that won't have any 0 eigenvalues. So that means that for polys, that M and N actually do commute. Okay? And that makes sense, right? Because from basic quantum mechanics that the way to get a space that's a joint plus one eigenspace of different operators is for those operators to commute. Right? If they don't commute, you have some uncertainty principle or something that prevents that. Okay? Okay, any questions so far? Okay. So this is great. So we have this for the 9-qubit code, and for any other code, we can define the stabilizer that has some nice properties in an abelian group. But actually, it turns out usually it's better to go the other way, to say, okay, actually, mostly I want to deal with the stabilizer. It's a lot easier to deal with, it turns out. And given a stabilizer, can I figure out again what the error correcting code it came from was? Now, for the most general error correcting code, you can't, right? The stabilizer does not uniquely define it. But there's a subclass of codes for which you can. Those are called stabilizer codes. So what we're going to do is, given S, which is a stabilizer, so S is going to be an abelian group. And minus identity is not in S, then we can define a subspace of the Hilbert space, the code space associated with this stabilizer. And to do that, we'll just kind of take that same definition for stabilizer and flip it around. So in particular, we'll say it's a set of states such that M psi is equal to psi for all M in S. Okay, so we're saying that we're just going to take the operators in the stabilizer, and we're going to take the joint plus one eigenspace. That's our code space. Okay, and then for a stabilizer code, so this is a definition of a stabilizer code. So if stabilizer code C, which is a subspace of the Hilbert space, then if you take the code space of the stabilizer of this code, then you get back the code. Okay? And 9-qubit code has this property. Okay, so 9-qubit code is an example of the stabilizer code. So I guess the first question that you would probably ask, given this definition, is how big is this subspace? Right, so that's a sensible thing to ask. How many qubits does it encode? So I'm not going to prove this, but I can give you the intuition. So if you're given a stabilizer, which has so first of all, the stabilizer, remember, it's an abelian group, and so all the elements commute, and moreover, everything squares to the identity, right? So we can list a set of generators like we did for this 9-qubit code, and then the actual elements of the stabilizer will be products of those generators, but never repeating. And the order doesn't matter because they commute, right? So how many elements are there? Well, the product can, for each generator, you can have it or not have it. So if there's r generators, then there's 2 to the r elements in the stabilizer. So S has r generators, then. And so if you have a stabilizer of that size, then it turns out that the dimension of the code space is 2 to the n minus r. So when there's n physical qubits. OK, which means that that there's n minus r logical qubits encoded in this code. Okay? So how does that work? I mean, like I said, I'm not going to prove it, but the intuition is actually fairly clear. Right? We start with a Hilbert space. The full Hilbert space has dimension 2 to the n. If we have all n qubits, could be any state. Every time we add a generator to the stabilizer, well, the Pauli operators that we're adding have eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1, right? And so we're splitting the Hilbert space in half and keeping only the plus 1 eigenspace, right? So we're going from first generator, we go from 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space to 2 to the n minus 1. And then we add another 1 and split it in half again, and it's 2 to the n minus 2. Another 1, 2 to the n minus 3. So when we add r generators, it's 2 to the n minus r. Now, the reason that's not a proof is because, you know, while each individual generator by itself is going to split the whole Hilbert space in half, in order to make that argument work, you have to show that it's also splitting the other plus one eigenspaces in half as well. And it does. That's true. But it requires some additional argument to show that. OK? So good. So we can pick a stabilizer. We just, you know, pick some abelian subgroup of the Pauli group. And given that, we can define a quantum error correcting code. And we know how big that quantum error correcting code is. But so far, we don't actually know if it's good at correcting errors or not. So that's the next step. But before I do that, are there questions on this stuff so far? OK. OK. So next step, then, is to understand how the stabilizers interact with the errors. Now, remember, we motivated the stabilizer by looking at the 9-qubit code. And there, the generators of the stabilizer were picked out to be the things that whose eigenvalues told us where the errors were, right? In particular, the z, the tensor products of z's tells us where the bit flip errors are, the x errors. And the tensor product of x's tells us where the z errors are. Okay? And the important property here is that each of those operators is identifying errors that anti-commute with them. Right? And so we can make that precise. So suppose we have some operator m in the stabilizer and some other error e in the polygroup. Okay? And so we know that the state psi is a plus 1 eigenstate of m. What about e psi? So psi has gotten the error e. Is it still a plus 1 eigenstate? Well, so there's going to be two cases. So the first case is where e and m anti-commute. Right? Since they're both polys, either they commute or anti-commute. So if e and m anti-commute, then m e psi is equal to minus e m psi, which is minus e psi. Okay? So e psi is now a minus 1 eigenvector of m. Right? So the anti-commuting error has transformed us from the plus 1 eigenspace to the minus 1 eigenspace. Okay, what about the case when e and m commute? Well, then m e psi is equal to e plus e m psi, which is equal to e psi. So e psi, in that case, is still a plus 1 eigenvector. Okay? So now we can see how we can use these stabilizers to at least detect errors, right? If we have a stabilizer, right, we start with a stabilizer code, there's been an error e, and if that error e anti-commutes with anything in the stabilizer, then the eigenvalue of that operator will change to minus 1, right? And so we'll be able to identify that there has been an error. And moreover, you can see that we have a lot of information about what error it is, because you know it'll change only some of the eigenvalues and only those for only those operators that it anti-commutes with. And so that's what we're going to use. And so in particular, we can define the set N of S to be, so given a stabilizer S, this will be the set of polys such that N commutes with everything in the stabilizer. Okay? And so you see that given the stabilizer S, N of S is the set of errors that you can't hope to detect, because they'll commute with everything and therefore leave the eigenvalues plus 1. And moreover, if you think about it, operators in N of S, they're going to map code words into code words, right? Because if you have E in N of S, then E commutes with everything in the stabilizer, which means that the state psi, E psi, is always going to have plus 1 eigenvalue for everything in the stabilizer, which, remember, was how we defined the code space, right? So if psi is in the code, then E psi is also in the code. So N of S is a set of things that map the stabilizer states in the stabilizer code to other states in the stabilizer code. But some of them actually are not mapping to different states, right? So notice that the stabilizer itself is always a subset of N of S. Why is that? Well, the stabilizer is an abelian group. So everything in the stabilizer commutes with everything else in the stabilizer, right? Which is means that they're in general in this set N of S. And things in the stabilizer, they will, in fact, map code words to code words, right? States from the code space to states in the code space. But they'll map them to themselves. Right? They act like the identity. So if we want to think of the errors that actually cause a problem, it's the errors that are undetectable but actually change code words. And I'm going to call that the set of undetectable errors. So that set is n of s minus s. Okay? So anything that's in n of s is going to map code words to code words. But anything that's actually in s will just map code words to themselves. And therefore, it's not really an error. Okay, but n of s minus s, those are things that map code words to other code words. And I know that they have to map something to a different code word, because otherwise it would be an s. Okay? So this is a set of undetectable errors. So now you can see we're really making progress, because if we want to make an error detecting code, we can come up with a stabilizer, and then we can instantly write down the set n of s minus s, and we know what errors can be detected and what errors cannot be detected by this code. Okay? So any questions on that?
Is the set of undetectable errors usually bigger than the set of detectable errors? Does it depend on the situation?
Let's see. So, I mean, so okay. So the generally the set of detectable errors is actually quite large, but yeah. I mean, the thing is that most of them are not independent necessarily. So it depends on how big S is. So what I can tell you is that the size of N of S. So if S has so if there's k logical qubits. So S has n minus r generators. The size of n of S is 2 to the n plus k. Actually, times 4 for phases, but that's not too important. So if you ignore the phases, it's 2 to the n plus k. Whereas the stabilizer is 2 to the n minus k. And all the polys altogether are 2 to the 2n, right? 4 to the n, again, ignoring phases. So the set of things that are outside n of s is going to be, 4 to the n minus 2 to the n plus k, which, because of exponentials, tends to be pretty big. But actually, kind of in some sense, a lot of them are sort of the same, right? They're doing the same thing. So it depends on the exact values of n and k as to actually how big these things are relative to each other. But any other questions? OK, so then the next step is to say, well, OK, so that's detecting errors. What about actually correcting errors, right? As I said, there's a lot of information here beyond just something in the stabilizer has eigenvalue minus 1. We know which things have eigenvalue minus 1. And that's going to tell us which errors we can have, or which error it could have been. So let's think about that some more. So in particular, the error syndrome, remember, is going to be basically the set of eigenvalues, plus 1, minus 1. Right? So which generators have eigenvalue plus 1, which generators have eigenvalue minus 1. And what we'd like is that error syndrome can identify which error occurred. Okay? So let's think about when do two errors have the same error syndrome, and when do they have different error syndromes? So they have the same error syndrome if and only if they commute with the same elements of the stabilizer, right? That's kind of definition. Suppose if they commute with the same elements of the stabilizer, that means that given M in the stabilizer, either E and F both commute with it, or E and F both anti-commute with it. And in particular, what that means is that if you look at the product E times F, and if you want to generalize, this turns out to be slightly better, look at E dagger F, but for qubits, it doesn't really matter. So E dagger F. Is always going to commute with M for all m in the stabilizer, right? Because if e and f both commute with m, then e dagger f commutes with m. And if e and f both anti-commute with m, then e dagger f also anti or also commutes with m, right? Because you get two minus ones when you move them through. Okay. So these are all equivalent, right? And what this is saying, based on that definition, is that E dagger F is in N of S. Okay? So the set of N of S is not just useful for talking about detecting errors. It's also useful for telling us when error syncrums are the same. Two errors have the same error syncrome if their product is in N of S. Okay? But again, there's a little bit of extra information here. Or it's not enough. Okay, so certainly it's the case that if E dagger F is outside N of S and their error syncrums are different, we can distinguish them as errors. But remember, for detectability, there was this other case of something being in the stabilizer. And it turns out that that's relevant here as well. And so in particular, if E dagger F is in the stabilizer, well, what's that saying? That's saying that E dagger F psi is equal to psi, which implies, well, it's equivalent to saying that F psi multiplied by E on both sides is equal to E psi. So sure, E and F have the same error syncrome. And the reason they have the same error syncrome is because they actually act the same way on all the code words. And this is true, remember, for all psi in the code. Okay, so in the case where E dagger F is outside N of S, that's good, we can distinguish the error syncrones. In the case where E dagger F is inside S, well, we can't distinguish the error syncrones, but we don't need to, because they act the same way. And you know, if one of those errors occurs, and we can't tell which one it is, but it doesn't really matter because we can correct the other one and it'll still correct us to the same state because they act the same on code words. Okay. And actually, this even occurs in the 9-qubit code, right? Because if you think about it, a phase error on the first qubit will flip the phase of the first set of three. But so will a phase error on the second qubit, right? And we have no real way of distinguishing between those. And that's codified in the stabilizer because Z tensor Z is in the stabilizer, right? So a Z error on the first qubit times a Z error on the second qubit, that's in the stabilizer. So they act the same way. Okay. And so the result then is that so S, the stabilizer code, corrects a set of errors E, poly errors, if and only if, when you look at products of pairs from E, that their products of pairs should be either outside N of S or inside S. So in other words, the product is not in N of S minus S, that set of undetectable errors. Okay? And so that tells us, given a stabilizer, we can use this criterion to determine, you know, what sets of errors we can correct. Now, there might not be a unique set of errors, right? It could be you can pick one set of errors, and it works, but it also works for a totally different set of errors, right? Because it's a property of the products of errors in this set. But normally what you want to do, of course, as we discussed before, is to say, oh, I want the set of errors to be all single qubit poly errors, or maybe all 1 and 2 qubit poly errors, or something like that. But the theorem applies more generally. If you want to say, oh, I want to correct, you know, phase errors up to 3 qubits, but bit flip errors only up to 1 qubit, you can do that too. Okay? Okay, So, yeah. So, so one more definition. Well, maybe two more definitions. So the we like to kind of, when we're thinking about this case of correcting errors up to 1 qubit errors or 2 qubit errors or whatever, we like to encapsulate the error correction properties of the code in a property called the distance. So the distance of a stabilizer code S is the minimum weight of some operator in this undetectable set. And so weight is just the number of qubits that this poly acts on, non-trivially. Right? So like z tensor I is weight 2. And the lower down ones that are tensor product 6x's are weight 6. OK? And so obviously this distance is important, right? Because it's telling us how big this set of undetectable errors are, how, you know, what the kind of the smallest error is that's undetectable, right? And in particular, it's important for this property because a code can correct t qubit errors if the distance is at least 2t plus 1. Why is that? Well, to apply this criterion, you have a t-qubit error and another t-qubit error. The product of them has weight at most 2t, right? And so if the code has distance 2t plus 1, then you know that anything of weight less than that, so 2t, for instance, cannot be an n of s minus s. Right, and therefore this criterion is satisfied. Okay. So, for instance, to correct 1 qubit errors, you want a distance 3 code. And it turns out that the 9 qubit code up there is a distance 3 code. Right, we already analyzed that. We saw that it corrected 1 qubit errors. So the funny thing is that remember we have this minus s. So it could be that n of s has things that are smaller than the distance, right? And the 9-qubit code has that property, right? It has some weight 2 things in the stabilizer. Okay, and so we say that the code is degenerate if S has, I should have left more space here. With f has operators with weight less than the distance. Okay, so that's a lot of formalism. Maybe I can pause if there's questions on that. Yeah.
Is there a sense that this is actually like a distance, in a sense? Like, can you do
yeah.
space and...
Yeah, so it's a discrete. So obviously, it has to be integers, right? The, mm-hmm. the values have to be integers. So it's what it is a... So it's a generalization, kind of a quantum version of... So, okay, so this, as I've defined it, is a property of codes. So it's not the distance between two things, but it kind of is. It's the distance, kind of number of qubits that you have to act on to change one code word into a different code word, right? And so as such, it's a quantum version of the classical Hamming distance. So you can also talk about the distance of classical error correcting codes, which I won't have time for. And the classical Hamming distance really is a metric. And if you have two bit strings, you can say how many places do they differ, okay? And that also takes integer values, but it, you know, satisfies all the definitions that you want for a distance measure metric, right? It's, you know, it's only zero if they're the same, and there's triangle inequality and stuff like that. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah, some quantum distance, Hamming distance, as a difference between states is hard to define in a sensible way. But conceptually, it's related to this classical one. Any other questions? Okay, so this formalism can pay off in that it's much easier to talk about stabilizers than to talk about subspaces. And given a stabilizer, this stabilizer approach, we can come up with a bunch of new error correcting codes. So I want to show you a couple of them. So before we had this 9-qubit code that corrected one error. But that's kind of a lot of qubits. Can we do better? And it turns out you can. And so the best quantum error correcting code that will correct a single qubit error is a 5-qubit code. So it has this stabilizer. So each row here is going to be one generator of the stabilizer. And I'm going to suppress the tensor products. So it turns out this this code is cyclic under permutations of the qubits. So I have 4 cyclic shifts of the same operator at the top. The fifth one I don't need to write down because it's the product of these guys. And so anyway, so this these 4 generators. So there's 5 physical qubits here, and 4 generators. So we know from that proposition over there that there could be one encoded qubit. And so we like to use this notation to indicate the properties of a code. So we have 5 physical qubits. And this here is k, the number of logical qubits. And then the distance of the code is 3. Now, I'm not going to show that to you. In this case, probably the easiest way to see that this distance code is distance 3, so this is a non-degenerate code. And so what that means is that all the error syndromes are different. So if you write down any single qubit Pauli operator, it will have some error syndrome, you know, a set of things plus or minus that it commutes with. And if you write down, you know, there's 15 of them in this case. And if you write them all down, you'll see that all of the error syndromes are different. Plus the identity has a 0 error syndrome. Okay. And so it turns out in this case that uses up kind of all the possible error syndromes, right? Because there's 2^4 of them. Okay? So that's the 5-qubit code. And we use this notation 513 with the double brackets. The double brackets indicate that it's a quantum stabilizer code. And then this is telling us the kind of the main properties that we're interested in about this code. Okay? So this is the smallest quantum error correcting code that encodes 1 qubit and corrects 1 error. But I want to show you another code, which is a 7-qubit code, which turns out to be pretty useful for fault tolerance applications. So this code, you know, has 7 physical qubits, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 generators. And it turns out to also have distance 3. So it's a 7-1-3 code. One nice thing about this code is that you see it has a set of generators up here that are all x's, and a set of generators down here that are all z's. And a code like this is called a CSS code. For Calderbank Shorstein, who invented this family of codes. They're nice because you can make them out of two classical error correcting codes. So one classical error correcting code will give you this x part and one that will give you the z part. In this case, they're both the same code. And you can't pick two arbitrary codes that have to satisfy some conditions so that these parts commute with each other. But it's not a complicated condition. And you know, you can apply the theory of classical error correcting codes to learn a lot and to come up with many codes in this family. Okay. And this code has a lot of symmetries, and that's what makes it useful for fault-tolerant quantum computation. I really don't have much time to go into that. Maybe I didn't do all the way up there, but okay. So let me just say a few words about fault tolerance. So far I've just focused on quantum error correcting codes, where you know the encoding part was perfect, then there was some noise in the transmission, which could just be memory, right? We could just be storing it for some time. And then we decoded it using, again, a perfect quantum computer where we measured the error syndrome that way. But realistically, of course, we don't have perfect quantum computers, and all of the gates and the encoding and the decoding, all of that is subject to error. And moreover, we don't just want to store information, we want to change it, we want to operate on it, we want to do quantum gates. Okay? So we have to assume that all of these possibilities are subject to error. And one thing we have to worry about is we have to control error propagation. So of course, if we have a gate that goes wrong, that can cause errors, right? Errors in the qubits that are affected by that gate. If it's a single qubit gate, that's just one qubit. But if it's a two qubit gate, it could affect both qubits that gate is touching. But it's actually a bit worse than that, because even if the gate is perfect, but there's an error that was kind of standing around previously, so suppose we have a controlled NOT gate like this, and there was a bit flip error up here, well, this second qubit will get flipped exactly when it's not supposed to, right? This was supposed to be a zero, this was supposed to stay the same, but now it's a one, so it gets flipped. And similarly, if it was supposed to be a one up here, then now this one doesn't get flipped when it was supposed to get flipped. So what happens is the error propagates. We start out with just one x error, but now we have two. Okay? And you can see that for an error correcting code, that's a problem, right? If you design your error correcting code to only correct one error, then even though there was only one error that occurred, kind of new error, it spread, and now you have something that you can't correct. Okay? So you have to be very careful in designing fault-tolerant circuits to avoid this sort of thing. And in fact, it's even worse than this, because Z errors can propagate the other way in a controlled knot. So if you have a Z error on the target qubit, you end up with Z on both qubits. So that's the kind of thing that makes fault tolerance rather difficult, is you have to come up with these special circuits that avoid error propagation. And so I'm not going to have time to really tell you how any of these fault tolerant constructions work. But basically the idea is you're going to come up with gadgets, so kind of more complicated sets of gates that will implement the things that you want to do on the logical qubits in a way that limits error propagation and is fault tolerant. So a fault tolerant protocol has to consist of a fault tolerant error correction procedure. You need fault tolerant state preparation. So for instance, you need a fault-tolerant way of making an encoded zero state, right? So that you can use that in your computation. Of course, you need also fault-tolerant measurement, so that, you know, at the end you can measure and find out what the answer is. And you need a fault-tolerant universal set of gates. So what's a universal set of gates? I guess this got skipped last week. So a universal set of gates is some basic set of gates that you can multiply together. Here, let me write this down. Call it G. Is a set that can be multiplied together to get any unitary. Okay. And you know, maybe let's just say SU2 to the N because we don't really care about global phase. Right? So you know, a quantum algorithm, the goal is to implement some unitary on the N qubits. And you have to do that not by just kind of writing down this whole huge unitary and just doing it, but you want to build it up out of smaller pieces, right? Individual quantum gates. And so you want a set of gates that will allow you to do any unitary. Of course, some of them will require many, many, many gates, exponentially many gates. That's OK. But we still want at least the possibility of doing anything. And so kind of a standard set of universal gates is single qubit gates and the controlled NOT gate. Okay, so if you can do all single qubit gates and the controlled NOT gate, you can, given enough of these gates, and this is, you know, you have n qubits, so the single qubit gates on any of the n qubits, c naught on, say, any pair. You can narrow that down, right? If you have c naughts just between certain qubits, that's enough. You can kind of work them around. But if you can multiply together long enough strings of these, you can get any unitary, exactly. Unfortunately, it turns out that this is not a suitable set for fault tolerance. Okay, you can't get all single qubit gates in a fault tolerant way. And it turns out that all fault tolerant constructions actually only give you a finite set of gates that you can do directly. Now, of course, you can multiply those together. But you know, even you know, arbitrarily infinite sequences of them will still only be a countable set. Right, and SUN is an SU2 to the N is an uncountable set. So if you want to have a universal set of fault-tolerant gates, you have to settle for something slightly less. Rather than exactly getting any unitary, you want to get close to. So this is exact versus approximate universality. So this is exact. But then there's sets of gates which are not exactly universal, but still allow you to get arbitrarily close to any unitary. And that's really good enough, because at the end, you get very, very close to your unitary, and then you make your measurement, and well, the probability of error is only kind of proportional to how close you were to the unitary, to the ideal unitary. And so if you're exponentially close, that's good enough. And so, so one very common set of approximately universal gates that's widely used in the theory of fault tolerance is the Hadamard, the R, so you remember I had this R theta gate, so this is R pi over 8 rotation. So this, you know, is so remember this is this matrix, e to the minus I pi over 8, e to the plus I pi over 8. And the control NOT gate. Okay? Okay, so anyway, the upshot is that there exists sets of fault-tolerant gates that are universal in this approximate sense. And you can come up with for the 7-qubit code, or even for the 5-qubit code, or the 9-qubit code. But the 7-qubit code tends to be better. You can come up with a full set of things like this. This is a full fault-tolerant protocol that lets you do everything fault-tolerantly. But of course, the 7-qubit code will only correct one error. But nevertheless, using this procedure, you can make the error rate lower. The logical error rate is going to be lower than the physical error rate. And so you might say, well, if we can do that once, why not encode again? Right? We'll take all of the qubits in the 7-qubit code and encode them again using 7-qubit code and fault-tolerant protocols. Then we can make the error rate even lower. And you can keep on doing that to make it as low as you like. And so that is kind of the outline of one of the main theorems of fault tolerance, called the threshold theorem. And so this says if the error rate, physical error rate, per gate or time step is below some threshold value, then you can do arbitrarily long with logical error rate epsilon, which can be as small as you like, and overhead in terms of extra gates, multiple of extra gates or qubits, which is polylogarithmic. So polynomial function of the log of the size of the computation you're doing or the error rate you're achieving. Okay. So what this is saying is that you can do fault tolerance. And the cost of doing it is not prohibitive. Okay? That you're not going up to exponentially many qubits or anything like that. You're only modestly increasing by some polynomial in the log of the size of the thing you want to do, the number of qubits, the number of gates you need. And this is really important because it says that there's this constant value, the threshold value. And if the experimentalists can get their error rates below that threshold value, then we can use a software solution to get the error rates down as low as we like. Okay? And therefore, we can do arbitrarily large quantum computations. So there's many, many things I could say about this. We're out of time. But this gives you the basic idea. And so this is really critical to say that actually quantum computing is possible in principle. Right? Because without this, to build a bigger and bigger quantum computer, you'd have to get the error rates down lower and lower. And at some point, that would probably not be possible. OK? I guess, see if there's quick questions.
Is there an actual number that you can?
I can tell you a lot of numbers. So first of all, it depends a little bit on your modeling of what types of errors you're worried about. So we can. At the level of rigorous proof, we can say if the errors are kind of probabilistic and, let's just say that, then the threshold value is at least 10 to the minus 3. So one error per 1,000 gates. Now, there's a lot of simulations that show that in kind of semi-practical protocols, you can get the error rates even higher than that, say for depolarizing errors, with like 7 times 10 to the minus 3, so like 0.7%. There's if you really want to work hard using lots and lots and lots of extra qubits, then you can maybe even get up to a few percent error rates. Any other questions? OK, thanks. I don't know what you're getting next, but new lecture tomorrow.
On Thursday, we're getting Kevin.
Oh, Thursday, okay.
Talking about optical implementations.
Okay. Okay.